And there's an even more unusual way to watch TV, and it involves ABC's hit drama Lost. The premiere of the show's final season airs tonight. Many fans hope this season will answer key questions and tie up loose ends. And a few hardcore fans couldn't wait, so thousands headed out to Hawaii this past weekend, where the show is filmed, to watch an advance screening of the premiere. Hawaii Public Radio's Ben Marcus was there.
Hawaii's lush tropical scenery is perfect for producing a show about a group of people stranded on a remote island. And local tour companies on Oahu have cashed in on the show's success. Driving this Lost tour is Matt Marici, a guide for Ed Cost Tours. Marici's brought these Lost fans to Waimanalo Beach. Before them is pristine white sandy beach and electric blue ocean. Marici holds a binder with pictures from the show, including one of this precise view.
This is the Thailand beach, okay? You can see this ridge line is right over there. Now, when they pan more this way, they added in computer graphic islands, so because it's supposed to be Phuket.
The group clicks away with their digital cameras. Tour guide Marici points out the peculiar body art some fans display, whether it's pictures of prominent Lost characters or Lost mottos.
I feel at home when I get crazy fans around, like my man here with the Shannon tattoo. I've had somebody with a Dharma tattoo. I've had newlywed couples that put the phrase, live together, die alone, in their wedding vows. You know, Jack says, if we can't live together, we're going to die alone, right? I mean, I'm telling you.
The day of the premiere, a large group of those crazy fans are meeting at Lulu's restaurant in Waikiki for brunch. Across the street, a 30-foot screen has been erected on the beach for the showing. Ryan Ozawa, who lives here on Oahu, helped organize this get-together for his fellow Losties.
There's many names for us. Losers has been used periodically, but yes, we're Losties.
Ozawa and his wife host a podcast devoted to Lost called The Transmission. At one point, it boasted more than 30,000 subscribers.
You've got the mainstream audience that loves it. It's a primetime network TV show, but you've really got the serious nerd contingent, the Comic-Con contingent, the people who, you know, have scale models of the USS Enterprise in their house. So bringing those two worlds together is frightening but fantastic.
What's grabbed the attention of Lost fans across the spectrum are the mysterious and complicated storylines. Ozawa says Lost came about at a time when social media hit its stride. The internet is filled with fans posting back and forth their own theories about characters and fleshing out the rich mythology of the show.
And because Lost is a global show, it's a global online audience. I mean, right on the beach, we've got folks from Turkey, New Zealand, Australia, just coming from all over the world. They're trying to argue about who came the furthest for this event.
Those bragging rights probably go to Rina Kapuya from Istanbul.
I have a 12-hour time difference with Hawaii, so I'm thinking I'm literally from across the world, and I don't think anybody's come farther. I'm the craziest of them all.
Later that day, as the sun set, thousands of fans filled Waikiki Beach for the screening.
Destiny.
Sorry, for you Lost fans who love spoilers, I'm not telling. For blogger, podcaster, and Uber fan Ozawa, there are only a few surprises since he's been stalking out these film locations for months. But for his wife, this was all new.
She was sobbing like a baby, trying hard not to, but the more she held it back, the more her body would shake. So I just loved it. It was fantastic.
For NPR News, I'm Ben Marcus in Honolulu.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
Last night, ABC presented the two-hour season premiere of Lost, a mystery-shrouded drama series in its final year. The network was so secretive about the show's contents, it made only the first 5 minutes available for critics to preview. So our TV critic David Bianculli is here the day after with a review, but before that, with a larger look at the Lost phenomenon.
The catch-22 with discussing the super-secret final season premiere of Lost is this. If you're a TV critic and you preview it the night before it airs, you really truly don't know what you're talking about. And if you wait until the next day, then everybody who cares either has seen it already or doesn't want too many details because they're waiting to see it on their own time, on their home recordings, or later as part of a DVD box set. But the way I see it, TV critics in the golden age of TV used to review everything the day after, because television was live. Reviews were for the record, for posterity. And sometimes, as in the case of the drama Patterns by a young writer named Rod Serling, after-the-fact reviews could make a reputation overnight, and eventually call for the live drama to be mounted again. With Lost, one of the things worth talking about, even the day after, is the whole idea of time shifting. In fact, it's perfectly appropriate, because time shifting turns out to be one of the show's central plot gimmicks. Characters spent last season popping in and out of various timelines, victims of a mysterious remote island whose unstable core somehow was able to play with time and even with space. The island itself, with all the people on it, was here one minute, gone the next. Now think of that, if you will, as a fitting metaphor for the entire series. Lost, the TV series, like the island, has vanished and reappeared on its own peculiar timetable. The last episode we saw was 8 months ago. And because of both a demanding production schedule and the recent writer's strike, Lost has gone from a fall TV staple to a mid-season relief pitcher. And as the time between seasons has stretched out and its plots and characters become more unpredictable and complicated, viewers have begun to vanish too. Last season's cliffhanger season episode of Lost, the one where the islanders successfully set off a nuclear device that was supposed to detonate a time shift and return them to a safe place before the plane crash stranded them there, was seen by an estimated 10 million people. By today's broadcast TV standards, that's a lot, but it's only about half of what Lost was pulling at its peak. Where, to use another Lost parallel, did the others go? Some got bored or confused by so many questions and so few answers. And some, while still loyal fans, have decided to wait until each season came out on DVD to enjoy them at their own pace and without commercials. Either way, this does not bode well for the chances for broadcast TV to continue making deeply textured shows such as Lost. But Lost is something ABC should be proud of and viewers should be supporting. When the show finally winds up this May, its finale will be, in broadcast TV terms, a big deal. And except for the crowning of the next American Idol, how many of those are left? My answer is, not many. And Lost, last night, began its final year by answering its own questions for a change. And this is the point where I'll start talking about the contents of last night's show, specifically. The 5-minute opening sent to critics was a tantalizing tease. It started by recapping that fade-to-white nuclear explosion that ended last year's finale. Then the white faded back to reveal clouds seen through the airplane window by Jack. Along with everyone else, he was back on the doomed flight, but this time it wasn't doomed. They made it through the turbulence and began their descent into the Los Angeles airport. That's what ABC showed critics in advance. But the very next moment, shown last night, depicted Jack back on the island, waking up, after having lost consciousness from the underground nuclear detonation. Oh man, was it all a dream? Was the time shift explosion a failure? As it turns out, yes. And no. The explosion split the timeline into two alternate realities. In one, our heroes are still on the island, convinced the escape attempt failed. In the other, they land safely in L.A., and we follow what would have happened to them had they not crashed. And already, it appears, they're better off on the island than off it. That's one mystery you can put in the solved pile. Another is whether John Locke, whom we saw killed by Ben, yet subsequently living on the island, was dead or alive. John Locke, the good guy, apparently is dead. But there's someone or something taking his place and his shape on the island. It might even be that strange smoke monster that pops up from time to time. And in this scene from last night's show, Ben, played by Michael Emerson, confronts John Locke, played by Terry O'Quinn, after Ben kills an island leader named Jacob because Locke told him to. Except that Ben suddenly realizes it may not be Locke after all.
What are you?
I'm not a what, Ben. I'm a who.
You're the monster.
Let's not resort to name calling.
You used me.
You couldn't kill him yourself, so you made me do it.
I didn't make you do anything. You should know. He was very confused when you killed him.
I seriously doubt that Jacob was ever confused.
I'm not talking about Jacob. I'm talking about John Locke. Do you want to know what he was thinking while you choked the life out of him, Benjamin? What the last thought that ran through his head was? I don't understand. Isn't that just the saddest thing you ever heard?
When John Locke said he doesn't understand, believe me, I know how he feels. I can't make sense of a lot of this yet, and to be honest, I'm not spending a lot of energy trying. It's like watching Twin Peaks. After a while, you either roll with it or you don't, and no final explanation will be as satisfying as the ride itself. That's why I think people who are hoarding these episodes and waiting to watch them later are missing most of the fun. Lost is best enjoyed fresh. It's the only time, with a shared sense of excitement, you can talk about it or review it the day after.
Deva Bianculli writes for TVWorthWatching.com and teaches TV and film at Rowan University. He's the author of the new book, Dangerously Funny, The Uncensored Story of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Every year, millions of people tune into the Super Bowl. Most watch for the football, but some actually watch for the flashy commercials. And of all the ads that will be turning heads this Sunday, the one making headlines now is one you won't see during the game. It's produced by the gay dating site ManCrunch.com. NPR's Sam Sanders reports.
The 30-second Man Crunch ad shows two guys on a couch watching a football game.
You suck!
They're rooting for two different teams. Then, they both reach for potato chips at the same time.
I wanna kiss this guy.
Their hands touch.
Really, really wanna kiss this guy.
They kiss. Rather comically.
We honestly did not think there would be any issue with the ad. It's quite harmless. It's not controversial. It's not sensational.
Dominique Friesen is a spokesperson for ManCrunch.com. He says CBS made his company wait almost 2 weeks for a decision on airing the commercial. And then, he says, CBS said no ad spots were left for the game. Actually, CBS was still selling ads as of this week.
I think the greatest disappointment is the discrimination and the anti-gay bias.
A statement from CBS says that ManCrunch didn't meet the credit requirements to pay for the ad. It would have cost up to $3 million. As a new corporation, the company has a limited credit history. ManCrunch says it offered to pay for the ad in cash, but wouldn't show NPR documents verifying that. CBS's statement also said the commercial's creative content is not within its broadcast standards. Susan Stastny is from Alexandria, Virginia. She'll be watching the Super Bowl, but more for the commercials than the actual game. She knows a bit about the ManCrunch ad controversy.
I wouldn't want to see that as a Super Bowl commercial, and that really is pushing an envelope of what today's society would, you know, be down with.
Yet, she thinks there's a double standard at play.
But of course, everyone likes the thought of a couple girls kissing, but they don't like the thought of a couple guys kissing.
A few years ago, candy maker Snickers ran a Super Bowl ad in which two men accidentally kiss while trying to eat the same Snickers bar. In the ad, the kiss disgusted them both. That ad was denounced as homophobic. This year, ManCrunch is calling on gay rights groups to boycott CBS and the Super Bowl. But the dating site is not the first business to have an ad denied. In fact, Brad Adgate, an advertising expert at Horizon Media, says that some corporations submit ads they know will be denied for the Super Bowl, just for the publicity of the rejection.
Once in a while you see companies who want to get more bang for their investment in the Super Bowl by putting on ads that are they know are going to be not accepted by the standards and practices of the network.
Adgate says the big game is one of the last TV shows to reach men and women of all ages. And even a denial with an audience that big can be good for business. So ManCrunch might not have it that bad after all. In fact, since the ad's rejection, web traffic to the dating site has almost doubled. Sam Sanders, NPR News.
This weekend, 100 million people are expected to gather around their televisions to watch the Super Bowl. And in the weeks building up to the game, much of the chatter has been about the plays between the plays, the ads. One ad in particular will feature Tim Tebow, a Heisman Trophy winner and a quarterback from the University of Florida.
This is an issue ad for Focus on the Family, an anti-abortion group. For a little pregame analysis, we're joined by James Othmer. He's a former ad man and the author of the book Adland, which was published last year. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, this is not the first issue ad. There have been anti-smoking ads, anti-drug ads run during the Super Bowl. But this one seems more controversial. I guess what I'm wondering is whether this is an appropriate audience for this message.
Well, Focus on the Family has already won the PR debate because it's the most talked about ad in the Super Bowl. Even if they were to be banned at the last minute, they'd still have gotten their money's worth tenfold because it's talked about, it's discussed, it's blogged. CBS changed their policy towards accepting advocacy ads last year, and this is really one of the first tests on that policy.
There do seem to be some limits, though, as to how far out there CBS wants to get.
There's a question regarding another company called ManCrunch.com, which is a gay dating service. They submitted an ad, and it was declined by CBS, and there's some contention as to the circumstances surrounding the decline. CBS at first was said to have said they were sold out. Then there was a question about ManCrunch's ability to have the money for the 30-second spot. Then it became an issue of standards and practices. So it became quite controversial because ManCrunch is not acceptable, and Focus on the Family with what appears to be a flat-out anti-abortion ad is acceptable.
One advertiser that is not in this year's lineup is Pepsi. For the first time in 23 years, the company will not advertise its sodas during the game, although there are some other PepsiCo brands which will run ads, like Doritos. The soda company won't. Why not?
Well, it's really quite a clever play on Pepsi's part. They're the first major brand to say, we're not going to be a part of this. We're going to commit more than $20 million to social media. Their absence is a topic of concern. Is social media the new wave?
So do you think Super Bowl ads still matter? Do you think the price is going to come down?
I don't believe so. The prices have held. $2.4 to $2.8 million for 30 seconds, approximately $90,000 a second for your ad, is a lot of money to spend, but you're getting 100 million viewers. Now you're also able to build an entire marketing program around your Super Bowl. It's not just the 30 seconds that you're on the air. It's months leading up to it.
Now, in 1984, Ridley Scott directed an ad for Apple that has become iconic.
We shall prevail.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh.
So, James Othmer, have you seen or heard of anything that could have the kind of impact that that ad did?
I think that was a perfect storm because it happened to be 1984, obviously, and it was heralding the onset of a new aspect of our culture, the personal computer generation. It only ran once. It made it almost J.D. Salinger-like. I don't see any ad coming forward that's going to have that kind of resonance and that kind of memorability. And every time I ever worked on a Super Bowl campaign where there was a chance of having a spot in the big game, everyone would reference 1984 to the point where we're all sick of it. But they aspire to it. I think the commercials are incredibly entertaining. One aspect of the advocacy aspect is these ads don't tend to be as entertaining. And if the Super Bowl becomes a platform for controversial advocacy-based ads, I think the entertainment value will go down.
And we'll all go get a beer.
We'll all go get a beer. Viewers will tune out. And then networks may rethink their policies once again.
James Othmer is the author of Adland. Thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you very much.